Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
There's much we don't know about our buried past in California. Tony Platt is author of a book about the plundering of Native American graves. Later in the hour, I'll be talking to him about his latest book, Grave Matters, Excavating California's Buried Past. My first guest's novel is based on a true story which unfolds on one of the Channel Islands off the coast of Southern California, once home to thousands of Indians. Local author R.C. Nidever is a former journalist and magazine editor, and his book is Finding the Lone Woman of San Nicolas Island. Rich Nidever, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. Great to be here.
Well, I'm calling you Rich, but officially on your book, you go by R.C. Nidever.
Correct.
Your pen name, so to speak.
Right.
Now, before I even opened your book at all, and I looked at the cover and thought, how in the world did he get interested in this little-known story, I mean, this obscure story of this woman that I don't think many people have ever heard of? How did you get interested in this story?
Well, it came to me through my own family history, actually. George Nidever, an ancestor of mine, who was a well-known pioneer in the early days of California, and he lived to be quite old. In his older years, a historian came and interviewed him about his life. And that was eventually published as an autobiography of his called The Life and Adventures of George Nidever. And, of course, when you have an unusual name like that, you know, when I saw a book about someone named Nidever, I had to read it, of course. And about the last 10 or 12 pages of that book, he talks about his involvement in the story of the Lone Woman of San Nicolas Island. And I just read that and thought, that's just one of the most amazing stories that I've ever heard. And I began researching it and found that there had really only been one book written that was kind of based on that story, which is, of course, the famous kids' book, Island of the Blue Dolphins. But I saw that maybe it would be interesting to write a book about that story told from a different point of view. And that's basically where I started from.
I'm just imagining how many families would be just delighted if they had a written record of their ancestor's life. How lucky you are, Rich.
Oh, yes. And lucky that George Nidever lived to be a very old man, because it wasn't until his late 70s, actually, that this historian found out about him and said, hey, there's not many left from his generation. And he went down to Santa Barbara and interviewed him, and eventually the University of California published the book.
So he was your great-great-grandfather, and do I have enough greats in there?
actually, he was my great-great-granduncle.
I see. Yes.
Right. I descend from his brother.
Because I was wondering when you were listing the— because your book, you call it a novel based on a true story. So I was wondering, in the story, the narrator's brother gets killed. And I was wondering if your great uncle had a brother named Alex. Are these names accurate? Do you know?
The brother of his that was killed by Indians was named Mark, and that was a different brother. Alex was his best friend. But George had an older brother named John, who was my great-great-grandfather. And also the only one besides George who ended up in California. So they were two of nine kids, and they were the only ones that they were both born in Tennessee, but ended up in California.
Mm-hmm. Because when I'm reading your story and you talk about where they were from, and I figured that that was accurate, that they were from Tennessee, and then they moved a little farther west, and then all the way west to California. So I figured that much you knew of your family history and that it was true.
Right. Correct.
And do you know if he had this animosity toward Indians, the real George Nidever. Do you know if that was true?
Yes. If you read his autobiography, the murder of his brother and the death of his friend both actually happened. And also his revenge killing of two Indians, which is in the book.
Yeah.
Those were in his, he chose to put those in his autobiography. So I know they really happened.
Yeah, that's hard for us in the 21st century to imagine that. We see it in movies all the time, but when it comes down to a real person in real life, it's hard to believe, yeah, I guess that really happened.
Yes, and it is difficult to make judgment on people from a different era.
Yeah.
But I felt that his decision to include those in his autobiography said that it was something that he wanted people to know about.
Mm-hmm. And that he was honest about it.
Right.
Yeah. Well, this ancestor of yours is telling this story, and when you tell the story, you tell it in his voice. You tell this story in the first person. So I'd like you to read from the beginning of your book where we meet this person who's a real person named George Nidever.
Sure. Well, he's telling the story as an old man. Most folks who have been around as long as me, just past my 81st birthday, love to gripe and grumble about how miserable it is being so damn old. You probably know one yourself, some old fogey who can't talk about anything but aches and pains and not being long for this world. But me, I'm not like that at all. I don't ever complain about old age or anything else. I learned years ago that it's about as worthwhile as blasting a shotgun at the sky because you don't like the weather. So why am I this way? Well, for one, I suppose I did enough complaining in my younger days for a whole lifetime, even one as long as mine. Not to mention that I expressed many of my complaints through the barrel of a gun. But there is another reason, one that is harder to explain. You'll have to hear the story I'm about to tell to really understand it. And then he goes on to talk about how he enjoys looking back at all of the interesting events of his life with his 81 years of perspective.
And we know he did this because he's telling the historian his story. So we know that the real George looked back at his life. But I'm wondering if you knew enough about his personality to know this was the way he looked at life, saying there's no good reason to complain about anything, even old age. Do you know if he was like that?
Well, I don't. And certainly...
Because it's admirable. we'd all like to be that way.
Right. In terms of his autobiography didn't often discuss his feelings, his emotions, that kind of thing. He talked more about events and places mm-hmm. and dates. But there's enough there, I think, to kind of read between the lines, and that's what I tried to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, go ahead and continue then what George is saying.
Well, he goes on to recount a little bit of his past and how many memorable days he's had in his life. But he says, however, the older I get, there is one day which stands out much more than any other, April 10th, 1835, which happened to be my 33rd birthday. It was a day that began like any other, but by the time it ended, I was a different person, for reasons that had nothing to do with being another year older. Three notable things happened that day. For a few terrifying moments, I was sure I was about to die. I began to learn not to complain so much. And an Indian woman got left behind on San Nicolas Island.
This is author R.C. Nidever. He's reading from his novel, Finding the Lone Woman of San Nicolas Island. And it is a novel, but it is based on a true story that happened to an ancestor of his. And I thought it was interesting, Rich, you're reading this particular day, April 10th, 1835. Said it happened to be my 33rd birthday. And then by the time I get to that day in your narrative, I'd forgotten, and he had too, oh, today's my birthday. I thought, yeah, I forgot that too, that day was his birthday. Very eventful day in his life.
Yes, it was. And it's kind of the day that ended up impacting many lives.
And this, I assume, was also true, that that was indeed his birthday, and all these special events are transpiring on his birthday, or is that just your own?
There's, like I said, fact and fiction in the book, and so some of these things are fictional.
But I assume that his age is about that. He's about 33 when this is happening, or did you have
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, it's pretty close.
So we learn then that there's an Indian woman that was left behind on San Nicolas Island. Do you find that many people have even ever heard of San Nicolas Island up here in Northern California?
No. They've heard of the Channel Islands. But if you ask them, I think the only Channel Island that people really know is, of course, Catalina.
Santa Catalina. Yeah, there's a song about that one. But this San Nicolas Island is one of those Channel Islands. And am I right to assume you visited this island?
Actually, I did not. It's now a Navy base.
Yeah, you do say that in your book.
And it's not, you can't just show up there and say, can I look around? I visited Santa Cruz Island to try to get an idea of what it felt like to be out there. But no, I actually have not visited San Nicolas.
And it's hard to imagine. You say thousands of Indians were living on these Channel Islands, and they were all wiped out.
Well, as a result of the mission era, which decimated Indian tribes along especially the coastal tribes. And these Indians out on the islands were affected by that too, as the Indians on the mainland were slowly kind of wiped out by disease and cultural dislocation, etc. The islanders also dwindled, and eventually there was only one island left with Indians still on it, which was San Nicolas. And a decision was made to send the ship out there to evacuate the last island-dwelling Indians.
My guest is R.C. Nidever. He has written a book, Finding the Lone Woman of San Nicolas Island. And this is a novel, but it's based on a true story. And you are writing this book, and you mentioned the mission era. And I think we Californians are more or less familiar with that, but why don't you review for us? I enjoyed this part of your book where you were reviewing this history of the missions in California. So why don't you remind people of this era that you're writing about?
Well, it began back in 1770 when Junipero Serra, who most people, of course, know, landed here. And they began building missions to convert the Indians to Catholicism. And they may have had good intentions, but turned out to be a pretty awful thing for the Indians. In particular, they brought diseases, which the Indians had never encountered before.
And thus had no immunity.
Right. But, you know, that unfolded, and it's what basically caused this story to happen.
Well, you mentioned that your ancestors started out, he was born in Tennessee. He comes to California. And there's a section in your book that's, I assume these things happen. It's rather heartbreaking. And for those of us of European background, it's shameful, I think. But you describe a scene that George witnesses. Well, why don't you read this section? This is on page 24, Rich.
Sure. He has already seen one kind of murderous outbreak against Indians, and he's kind of wondering what's going on. And then this is right after he's arrived in California and he's out hunting. He sees Indians lined up on their knees, surrounded by Mexican soldiers and a Franciscan priest. So he kind of hides and says, I soon realized I was witnessing an execution. What I couldn't understand, though, was why, before each Indian was shot, he was first baptized by the Franciscan priest. Again, I wondered what on earth was going on. Why were apparently defenseless Indians being shot down in such a way? And why was the holy sacrament of baptism a part of this? A few days later, I began to get some answers to these questions. Thinking about it now, I realize that the story of the lone woman of San Nicolas Island didn't really start on April 10th, 1835. Actually, it begins way back in 1770, when a Franciscan missionary named Junipero Serra first arrived in California.
My guest is R.C. Nidever, and he is reading from his novel, Finding the Lone Woman of San Nicolas Island. And you've described this person telling this story in the first person. The narrator was a real person who was an ancestor of yours. And he says that before each Indian was shot, he was first baptized by the Franciscan priest. That just doesn't make sense to some of us, I think.
It's crazy. It really is. But this was the kind of thing that happened. And I might add, anybody familiar with Native American history knows that this kind of thing happened not just in California, but elsewhere. There were, I think, some priests and some of the missions that were better than others. But when the converts begin trying to escape, they would hunt them down and usually bring them back. But in this case, they lined them up and executed them. And this was an actual recorded event.
Well, and you might remind us, too, that California was first not, it was called California, but it belonged to Spain and then New Mexico. So at this time this execution is taking place, what was California? Who did it belong to?
Well, George Nidever arrived in California in 1834, and that was about 10 years after Mexico gained independence from Spain. So it was originally Spanish and then Mexican. And then in the mid to late 1840s, the United States and Mexico went to war, and it became part of America.
So this is during the mission era, as you refer to it. And there are other characters like this California that had been there for years, and some of these other characters were real people, I'm assuming. What were some of the other characters that were actual people in your story?
Well, his wife, Sinforosa Sanchez Nidever, he married a Mexican woman and settled in Santa Barbara and would spend the rest of his life there. And she's a big part of the book. She's kind of the conscience of the book in some ways. And his close friend Zach, whose name was Isaac Sparks, was a real person. But some of the characters are fictional.
And you mentioned, too, that this name, Nidever, that's kind of an unusual name. You've got his wife with he calls her Rosa. And where does that name come from, Nidever?
Well, it's actually of German origin. Typical American story of a name that the first generation of kids think is too difficult to pronounce. So apparently it was originally Neithofer. And they kind of shortened it to Nidever.
For the convenience of Anglos.
Right.
Oh, we didn't mention that he was an excellent hunter.
Right.
Good shot. And so that plays a role into how he got involved in this island. So you might mention how that happened, how that came about.
Right. When he lands in Santa Barbara, he and his hunting partner, Zach, find a ship, which is the first locally built ship available to charter for hunters. And so they chartered it. But before they could leave and go out hunting, they are ordered instead to go to San Nicolas Island and remove these 17 Indians who they find out are kind of their population is dwindling and they can't survive there anymore. And so that's really, and the day they arrive to evacuate them is April 10th, 1835. And as you find out, not everyone makes it off the island.
And years go by and they wonder, as they're sailing away and they look back and they can't turn back. The weather is against
right.
them. And so they see this woman there, and they wonder, well, what happened to her? And a lot of times when you are raising questions, say in George's mind or somebody's mind, I'm thinking, I'll bet that was those were also questions that were in your mind when you were writing this story, that answers that, that questions that you didn't know the answer to. And the theme of your book, I really enjoy the fact that you are trying to figure out, what is fate? How did this all come about? And there's a section in your book, this is on page 115, where you're musing about that very question.
Right. And because what happens is, as you find out, that the woman is left behind. The ship that took them out there sinks before they can make it back out. And then the woman is eventually more or less forgotten. But then something happens that makes them realize that, well, perhaps she could still be alive. So years later, they go out there and they find footprints. But once again, weather plays a role. Before they can find the woman, a storm hits and they have to leave. And as they're about ready to head back out there is when George starts thinking about fate. He says...
Because there were a combination of reasons, things that kept them from going back and getting this woman.
Right.
Problems kept coming up to keep them from doing that.
Yes, and keep in mind, too, that San Nicolas Island is the farthest island of the Channel Islands. It's not an easy place to sail to, especially back in those days. So people had no reason to go out there. And it was basically an island that just sat alone, unseen, unvisited, and forgotten for years and years until he went back out there finally.
And his original region, he was interested in hunting. He was a hunter.
Right.
And that was his interest in the island. And you do describe that scene when they say, oh, footprints. She must be alive.
Right.
Because they didn't know. All those years that went by, 18 years, and they don't know if that woman is still alive. And they see footprints. But you then are wondering, well, what exactly is fate?
What is fate exactly? And this is George kind of getting philosophical. Whenever, is your life somehow determined before you even live it? How much control do we have over it? Is it all in God's hands? Why do some people meet better fates than others? And why should anyone suffer a fate like that of the woman on San Nicolas Island?
My guest is R.C. Nidever. He's reading from his novel, Finding the Lone Woman of San Nicolas Island. And in that musing, George says, is it all in God's hands? And it's interesting. I find it interesting why George became a Catholic.
Because it was a requirement to marry his wife. So he had to do it. But that also introduces into the book another interesting character, Father Gonzalez, who is like his wife, believes all through those years that the woman is still alive and that someday, eventually, someone will go out there and find her.
Yeah, so he sees this beautiful woman, and he wants to get to know her. And this is the Rosa, who eventually becomes his wife. But his family insists that he become a Catholic before they'll let their daughter marry him.
The way it was in those days.
And I'm guessing that is true for your ancestor.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know how devout he was.
Well, but at least he fulfilled the requirement to become Catholic. So you're wondering, why do some people meet better? Or George, the character who's narrating, the narrator is wondering, why should anybody suffer a fate like that of the woman on San Nicolas Island? But he seems more upset about it than she does, because they don't know when they find it. They see the footprints, and since the title of your book says Finding the Lone Woman on San Nicolas Island, because for a while I'm reading, I thought, are they ever going to find this woman? And then I remembered, oh, the title tells me that. Okay, so they find her. And there's all sorts of attitudes she could have about life. She could be depressed. She could be sad. She could be angry at them. And what was she like? And how much of this is true, and how much did you have to fill in?
only two in-depth first-person accounts of the story, and one was by George Nidever, and the other one was by a man named Carl Dittman, who actually, Isaac Sparks and Carl Dittman are kind of blended into one character in my book. But Nidever and Dittman left behind accounts, and one thing they both talked about relatively extensively was her personality. And when they first found her, she was friendly. She was always smiling and laughing. She was always happy to try to help in any way she could. They were just kind of shocked that she seemed to be a very happy, generous, gracious person, full of grace. And to me, that's kind of another thing that makes this such an amazing story.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading about her and the fact that here's this woman who lived alone all these years and could have developed all sorts of angry feelings.
Right.
And yet she was happy, and they couldn't communicate. They didn't speak each other's language.
Right.
But she was willing, and then she breaks out into song.
Yes. Yes.
So I'm guessing the eyewitness, that was really true, that this woman must have started singing a song.
Yes. When they finally found her and brought her back to Santa Barbara, it was a huge, huge thing. And the night of her home was immediately just surrounded by people wanting to see her. And in his recollections of the story, George Nidever says that the woman loved to sing and dance for the great enjoyment of both children and the older ones, he says. So,
well, somebody this entertaining might make a good show to put on the road, huh?
Right.
One of your characters thinks of that. Ooh, we can take her to San Francisco and...
He was offered a huge sum of money by two different ship captains to let them take the lone woman away and, you know, make her part of a freak show, basically. But fortunately, they turned him down.
Yeah, in the story, Rosa is the one who got incensed.
Yes.
That ain't going to happen. Yeah. So she wasn't going to let that happen. So that's an attractive feature, attractive her personality is. And then you run into, well, what was her name, this woman who lived all alone? And what did they learn was her name?
You know, amazing thing about the story is that her true Indian name was never recorded or written down. Nobody knows. She was given the name Juana Maria, and that's kind of what she's still known as. She's known as the lone woman of San Nicolas Island, but also Juana Maria.
Well, we don't want to give away what happens to Juana Maria because people, I think, will be fascinated by this story and will want to learn, well, then what happens? It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Rich, about this book.
Thank you. Great to be here.
After a break, author Tony Platt will tell us about the plundering of Native American graves. His latest book is Grave Matters, Excavating California's Buried Past. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is the author of 10 books and more than 150 essays and articles on race, inequality, and social justice in American history. Retired professor Tony Platt taught at the University of Chicago, the University of California, Berkeley, and California State University, Sacramento, where he received awards for teaching and scholarship. He has been a visiting professor at universities in Tokyo and Belfast, and a visiting researcher at the Huntington Library and the National Museum of American History. He has written for the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, History News Network, and The Guardian, and his commentaries have aired on NPR. His latest book is a history of the treatment of Native American remains in California. The title of the book is Grave Matters, Excavating California's Buried Past. Tony Platt, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, you know, this book sounds like something that an anthropologist would write. You're not an anthropologist, are you?
I'm not an anthropologist. I really think of myself as a historian, though I was trained in sociology. And I came to this from outside of anthropology. It's the kind of book that you would hope anthropology would be writing about its own history, but in general, they've stayed away from some of these subjects.
Well, how did you become so passionate about Native American burial sites?
Well, I'm lucky to have a cabin that I share up on the northwest coast in a place called Big Lagoon above Trinidad and Eureka. Been coming here since the mid-70s. And a few years ago, I read a technical report that was written by a local archaeologist. And in that report, there was a paragraph saying that about 200 yards away from where our cabin is on a beautiful meadow, in the middle of the 20th century, people had come in there and dug up the graves of the Yurok Indians and taken away not just the artifacts they found there, but also the human remains. And as a historian who's concerned about the issues of history, particularly the tragic side of history, I felt I couldn't ignore this in my own backyard, literally. And so I decided to start working with people to protect this area, and that protection of the area led to my investigation, trying to figure out how did this happen, who were the people involved, where did the artifacts and human remains end up, and that led me on a long journey and eventually to this book.
Well, there was a personal part of this besides the public reason. There was a personal reason that you were interested in this.
Yeah, a very personal part. My son died a few years ago. And not long before he died, he said that he would like to have a funeral. Actually, he said a Viking funeral in Big Lagoon. And after he died, we respected his wishes and sent his ashes off in this wonderful ritual into the lagoon here. And for the first time, I started thinking about issues of mourning and rituals of death. And his death began to really change my relationship to this place. Not necessarily in a macabre way, because I have a very positive association with him and with his history here. So it was a sense of trying to bring him to life after he was gone. And that experience, plus the experience of discovering the grave sites, or the looted grave sites of the Yurok Indians here, both of those things sort of propel me into this project. This wasn't a book that I set out to do rationally and purposefully and planned from the beginning. This was a book that really demanded that I do it. It was an investigation that propelled me into this history that I knew very little about.
My guest is Tony Platt. His book is Grave Matters, Excavating California's Buried Past. And that excavating California's buried past has a lot of meaning beyond just the physical digging up grave sites. But when you dug into California's past, you found that it wasn't a very pretty picture.
It's not a very pretty picture, which is to be expected if you're a historian looking at the history of any important region in the world. But what I also discovered was that while we have a lot of histories of different parts of California, particularly the Northwest, that we don't do a very good job of developing a public history, a public memory of this past. And this tragic history is not just the genocide of Native people in the Northwest and then the subsequent looting of their grave sites and their dispossession, but it also includes the history of Chinese who were expelled from the many places on the West Coast in the 19th century and the expulsion of the Japanese American in the middle of the 20th century. And even the Gold Rush itself is full of its sorrows and its tragedy because of all of the pioneers and settlers who came up here hoping to strike it rich and ended up impoverished and broke and often very ill and disillusioned. And all the way up to the present now, not too far away from my cabin here in Big Lagoon, is the prison at Pelican Bay that has thousands of prisoners, mostly African-American and Chicano, who are far away from their home places and held under the most abysmal and unconstitutional conditions. So I think we have a very profoundly tragic and sorrowful history, but we do a very poor job of bringing this into our classrooms and into our public memory.
In fact, you used a word that I never remember in my history books when I was studying history. You used the word genocide, and that's something that happens in other countries, in Rwanda or Germany. It doesn't happen here in California.
Right. In fact, there's certain terms that I use for what happened here in California, you know, apartheid, ethnic cleansing, pogroms, genocide. These are terms that we usually think about in terms of other parts of the world. And in fact, many of our students in the seventh grade read things like The Diary of Anne Frank and learn about the Holocaust in Europe and may even learn about the genocide in Rwanda. But for the most part, people don't learn this tragic history of what happened to Native peoples, and certainly very few people use the G word of genocide to describe it. But I think historians are now pretty clear that what took place in the middle of the 19th century was a genocide. It was systematic, it was intentional, it removed people from their homelands, it broke up families, it sold women and children, it tried to do away with the native cultures of young people. It was a very, very systematic form of trying to get rid of a whole set of peoples. And I don't think the word genocide is an overstatement or rhetorical when it's used in this context.
Well, not only do we not hear the word genocide, but we are led to believe that, well, these people would have gone extinct anyway.
Right. I think trying to understand how these atrocities could take place, and then how could people learn to live with that and sleep at night and not be troubled by it. I went through a lot of literature that I call the California story, all these magazines and newspapers and textbooks and memoirs and novels and stories that were so popular throughout the 20th century that were read by millions of people, not just in California, but around the country and sometimes in other parts of the world. And when they describe the history of Native peoples in California, they refer to Native people as vanishing, as being sort of an inferior and quaint race, somehow exotic, biologically deficient, and gave the sense to me from reading all this material that they would have vanished if there'd been no action taken against them, and that they were somehow biologically deficient and predestined to disappear. And all this writing, this construction of these myths and fables about the native past took place while native people were persisting and while there was warfare and resistance, sometimes guerrilla warfare in the Northwest. And there's evidence of people continuing to live here all the time, you know, getting married, having kids, having their own rituals and ceremonies, and even giving interviews to anthropologists and reporters who came by to interview them. So there's no question that they were still here and that they persisted, yet the literature is filled with this image of a vanishing race.
So if you ask yourself the question, where did the Indians go, meaning Native Americans, they're still here.
Right. They never left. I mean, it's remarkable that actually on the Northwest Coast, where the worst atrocities took place, that when I went back and looked at public records and census records, they continued to live here, and some became traders, some sold the information that they had to the settlers and pioneers, some had kids, some became farmers, some became gold miners. A lot, of course, then ended up in jails and in reservations, and kids got sent off as servants to different parts of the state. But they're very much a presence here throughout that whole time, and now, of course, have grown into a large part of the California national population. The tribe that I've been working with, the Yurok tribe, has 5,000 members today and is the largest tribe in California.
My guest is Tony Platt, and we're talking about his book, Grave Matters, Excavating California's Buried Past. It's a history of the treatment of Native American remains in California. And we have kind of we call him Ishi, but we don't know really what his name was because he didn't give his name. And the white settlers said, well, these Indians won't give their names. They won't tell us about their traditions and their religion. And why did they not do that? We expected them to tell us their names.
Well, I have to remember that Ishi was a survivor of the Yahi people who was surviving under impoverished conditions. But when he was found and literally captured and then taken to San Francisco, that he was a survivor. There were probably other people besides him, but he got named by the media as sort of the last surviving member of that tribe, which probably wasn't true. But
in fact, in all of North America, he was called the last wild Indian in North America.
He was, and he was paraded and shown off like he was sort of a carnival freak, and people came from all over the region to see him before he was moved to San Francisco. People came in the hundreds, if not thousands, to see him in the jail. I guess he was in Oroville there. And then in San Francisco on Sundays, people would come from all over the state to see him and watch him. But he was also somebody who was a survivor of extraordinary trauma. You know, his people had died and been killed and been hunted, and he was suffering from all kinds of traumatic disorders as a result of that, and he was in a very strange place around strange people. So we can only assume that he was trying to keep some kind of integrity and privacy during this time when he was this public object.
In fact, when you read characterizations of what the Native Americans were like and you hear words like reticent or depressed, well, good grief.
Yeah. Well, one of the famous anthropologists from Berkeley, Alfred Kroeber, who was world known and was responsible for building up the Berkeley School of Anthropology beginning in the early 1900s and building up the museum that became the Hearst Museum, he was describing people that he interviewed in the late 19th and early 20th century as being depressed and reticent and angry and subdued. And what was remarkable to me when I read his accounts of these survivors is that he didn't then speculate as to what it was like to be a survivor and to hear these stories of incredible atrocities. And no wonder they were depressed and reticent and worried about their past and refusing to cooperate with people that wanted to interview them and make them into kind of exotic specimens. So it was rather remarkable because Kroeber knew about the tragedies and knew about the atrocities and yet refused to speak publicly about that.
Yeah, in fact, you mentioned him as being in the forefront of this information that we have about the Native American burial sites, and an anthropologist that kind of turns out to be a good guy when you look at what some of the other anthropologists were doing. I kind of have that feeling. How did you feel about Kroeber and his work?
Well, I'm ambivalent about Kroeber. I try to provide a portrait of him as a human being with strengths and weaknesses. I mean, he did extraordinary anthropological work, going around and talking to people and interviewing people and recording their songs and ceremonies and getting their stories. And much of that information gives us real insight into the world in which people lived prior to contact. And there are many tribal groups and native groups that continue to draw upon his research and his writings as a way to reconstruct their ceremonies that for a long time had not been practiced. So that part of him was quite extraordinary. I think, on the other hand, he didn't speak out about the genocide. He didn't encourage his staff and other anthropologists to speak out about that. He was not concerned, really, with the contemporary situation of Native Americans and focused only on what he called their Aboriginal past. And also, he tended to portray them quite often as being rather static and one-dimensional. He didn't get at the different dimensions of who they were and how they changed over time. So I think it's a mixed picture, and that's why so many Native peoples in this part of the country up in the Northwest are very ambivalent about him.
Well, an anthropologist in general, when you realized how the researchers treated the researched. It's not a very pretty picture there.
No, because they're basically not taking into account the situation that they're in, which is extraordinary poverty and dispossession and recovering from great trauma, and they're going around, and their primary interest is in collecting their stories and hustling them to get information from them and objects from them so that they can fill museums with this stuff.
Yeah, because they relied on them. They didn't know where the sites were, so they rely on their informants to give them information.
Right.
But all take and no give.
Right. Then you have all these local archaeologists, amateur archaeologists, who are digging up burial sites, because in burial sites they're going to find what become very valuable artifacts that they can sell or keep or trade. And the universities and the scientists want the human remains. So it's like a deal that's being struck between the professional anthropologists and the amateurs in the local regions. So the amateurs are saying, here are the graves, and we'll keep the artifacts, and you can have the bodies. And all of that was done despite ongoing opposition from native groups and despite the violation of human rights that this involved.
My guest is Tony Platt, and we're talking about his book, Grave Matters, Excavating California's Buried Past. And before we get too intent on feeling that Californians are the only ones that did this, when I lived in South America, lived in Peru, and that was kind of a hobby that a lot of, particularly the wealthy, had, was finding the grave sites, and each house just about had their collection of artifacts from the graves that had been plundered there. But also in our own history, before the mid-19th century, Thomas Jefferson plundered graves on his property.
Oh, yeah, this is not just a local or California operation. This is going on worldwide. And in the United States, you're right, you have the example of Thomas Jefferson in the late 18th century digging up 1,000 graves and then writing notes about them. And you also have examples in the 18th century of the big military expeditions from Europe, the Vancouver one being the most famous one on the West Coast, that's going up and down the region and making contact with local tribes and native groups, and then trading, and also then digging up graves and taking stuff away. So,
although Vancouver did tell his men not to do that.
He did, but it was sort of a double message, because on the one hand, he said, don't dig up graves. On the other hand, it was expected that these military expeditions would go back to Europe, particularly to Spain and to England, with tons of artifacts that would then find their way into various museums and collections. So even though Vancouver frowned upon the practice, a lot of his men were actually digging up graves and taking stuff away.
Well, you mentioned Spain, and a lot of sources imply that that's when the history of the area there on the coast began. It didn't begin until the Spaniards came and named it Trinidad.
Yeah, exactly.
But there was no history before that.
Right. You have all these textbooks, and this is the history that children get, that history begins with the Spanish, and then it sort of jumps to the Victorian era. And you have all these quaint historical villages and fishing and lumber and tourism and so on, and that earlier history for thousands of years either gets dropped out, or it gets condensed into a paragraph, or it gets sort of presented as a prologue to history, not as history itself.
In fact, one source referring to the Yuroks said that they are a very private people with a warlike nature. Is that even true?
I'm having trouble hearing you.
I said one source described the Yuroks as a very private people with a warlike nature. Is that even true?
Yeah, that's true. That's a contemporary tourist book that talks about native people now as being, you know, reticent and warlike and suspicious and so on, which is exactly the opposite of my experience, that I've had a lot of cooperation in the work I've done on the research for this book, and a lot of people have talked to me and taken me into their homes and trusted with me information and been very supportive of the whole project.
So that misinformation continues right until the present day.
Oh, yeah. Tourist books are full of misinformation and romantic stories about the past. And and school children also get a lot of these images in the classroom and in their textbooks. It's very despairing at times to see how little this has changed in terms of the public information that's put out there.
In fact, I'm sure history teachers appreciate your quote from Joan Didion about California. She says, the future always looks good in the Golden State because no one remembers the past.
That's true. California has been always one of these places that has emphasized, you know, the future and progress and, you know, we're going to do better and better. But I think that the current economic and social and cultural crisis is actually pushing people to be more reflective about the past and to think about how do we get to this place. So I'm hopeful that there's going to be more openings for these kinds of discussions.
In fact, one kind of exception was when a slave cemetery was discovered in Manhattan, or rediscovered, the African Burial Ground in New York, the African Burial Ground National Monument, became what it is because community organizations forced Congress to halt excavations.
Yeah, I think that's an extraordinary example, and to me it's the model of what we can do. This was the African slaves in the 17th and 18th century in New York were buried outside the city limits, and then a few years ago when they were digging up the ground there to build a huge federal building, they started digging up these graves, and Dinkins was the mayor, African-American mayor of New York, and community organizations immediately got the mayor to halt construction. And out of that has come a rather remarkable memorial that is now a federal monument with a very sorrowful, beautiful, dignified memorial that's there that people can go and stand at. Also, many of the human remains have been reburied in that place. And next to it also is an excellent educational memorial that students and visitors and tourists can go to that explains the history of slavery in New York and explains the history of this community. And this is one of the few places, I think, in the United States where we do commemoration and education together in a very successful way. It's really a model for the kinds of places that I'd like to see throughout California.
Well, you mentioned repatriating remains and sacred objects. I think people would be surprised at the sheer quantity of them. For example, this one dentist dug up 600 skeletons. And then you mentioned that in your book that at Berkeley, the Hearst Gym has just rows and rows and rows of bodies stacked. And the labeling isn't adequate. So how do you go about putting these remains back where they belong? And where do they belong?
Well, you know, we only have a rough estimate of how many native graves were dug up. Some people think as many as a million, which I think is quite possible. And under legislation called NAGPRA that was passed by the federal government in 1990 after a long efforts of lobbying by Native American organizations, all federal institutions now have an obligation to publish lists of human remains and artifacts that may have come from graves, and then the tribes and native groups have the right to petition for the return of those. And I think that's the right thing to do. That's the right legal and political way of handling that. The problem is that still most human remains have not been repatriated, and most artifacts have not been repatriated. Berkeley, for example, the University of Berkeley still has 100,000 human remains in one of its basements on campus. So this remains a continuing source of frustration for many native groups, and many of these human remains that were supposed to be scientifically studied ended up just being dumped in boxes and in basements, were never studied and never documented properly. So it's a real issue about what to do with those human remains now when I don't think we'll ever know where a lot of them actually came from.
Well, there's a very famous Native American, Geronimo, and then how do you decide, should he be buried where he was born or where he died?
Yeah, tribal communities, you know, have their differences about whether or not to try to get back human remains. Some organizations and tribes think that Native remains that have been in somewhere else's basement for so long have been contaminated spiritually, and sometimes contaminated physically, too, by different kinds of preservatives and arsenic and so on. Other groups want to have human remains come back and rebury them, and that's happened out here in Northern California and many other places. So it continues to be a troubling issue, but I think it's an issue that universities and museums and other places that have human remains need to take some initiative on and need to make some proposals about how to deal with this. I think we need more public kinds of memorials, maybe public burial grounds, maybe symbolic reburials. There are lots of ways to do this, and that's why the monument in New York, I think, is an example for that.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned in your book that the Yuroks want back their ceremonial artifacts rather than their funerary artifacts.
Well, yes, under this legislation from 1990, tribes have a right also to claim ceremonial artifacts, however they got into museums or universities, things that have been used for spiritual practices. And so if you can show that you have a connection to certain items and that those items have ceremonial value to you, you can get them back. And in fact, a few months ago, a group of people went to Washington, D.C., to the Smithsonian, and brought back 100 to 200 items that they plan to use again in ceremonies. So that's a very moving thing when you can actually find things that you know were taken and that have ceremonial value. And some tribes are being successful in doing that. The problem is that this is expensive and time-consuming for tribes. And for native groups that are not federally recognized, they don't have the right to get things back. And so it requires you to be officially recognized. It requires that you have people who are skilled at doing this. You need money and resources to write the proposals and get things back. And we've made, so far, very little gain, I think, in continuing to complete this process of repatriation.
You know, it's interesting, and you mentioned this in your book. You talk about how expensive it is to do this. But, you know, we as a country don't spare any expense to bring back the bodies of Vietnam soldiers, the veterans from Vietnam. We feel that we should do this. We should honor these, our dead, so to speak. So there seems to be a double standard there.
Yeah, I think there is a double standard. I think you're right. I think there are the two examples of how this double standard operates is that after the Civil War, the country made huge efforts to set up cemeteries and to identify the soldiers. You know, something like 2% of the country died during the Civil War. But after the war, there were these huge efforts to create these very dignified cemeteries and to acknowledge the people who died. And that was a result of a social movement led by the survivors and families of Civil War veterans.
So in spite of all the frustration that you feel as a reader going through your book, you do leave us on a hopeful note. So thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you.
My guest has been Tony Platt. His book is Grave Matters, Excavating California's Buried Past. I'd also like to thank my first guest, R.C. Nidever, author of Finding the Lone Woman of San Nicolas Island. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.